I have to be careful of being recorded. Reminds me of a great story. I was once on a committee in Denver, and it was a committee to build a mikveh, and something came up, I don't remember what, that was very sensitive. And for some reason, they used to record all the meetings, and they recorded the meetings because they thought that somehow or another, in the process of this community project, that people were able to hear what went on at the meetings, that would be kind of an educational process. But in any event, this particular meeting, they didn't want to record it. It was very sensitive, can't record this. So I had a colleague who was a rabbinic advisor to this committee, and he made an unbelievable statement. He said, "But it's being recorded. Everything we do is recorded. So we didn't turn on the recording machine, but it was being recorded." Reminded me of that. Several years ago, I used to teach in a what we now call a gap year program. In those days, we called it learning in Israel. It was the same thing. At an institution called BMT, Beit Midrash LaTorah, which, if I'm not mistaken, no longer exists. There may be some other institution with that name. But in any case, it used to meet on the Gruss campus. And there were a number of students in the class, you know, like here. And I was teaching a class in Mussar. And one of the things that I did over the course of the year was I would take the kids, or make it possible for the students to hear one of the great Balei HaMussar of Jerusalem. One of the great Balei HaMussar in those days was Rav Eliezer ben Sion Brook, and I was a Talmid of his, and he was an unbelievable personality, an unbelievable teacher, and he was whatever it was at that time, 50 years my senior, and I thought that he could certainly give the students something that I couldn't. So we went to his yeshiva. He was wounded in the 1948 war, and it was hard for him to walk, so we went to his yeshiva. Sort of open parentheses, let me tell a little story about Rav Brook. I told he was wounded, it was hard for him to walk. So the way I got the story was that after he was wounded, he was told he'd never walk again unless he moved. He lived on the ground floor, and he lived in Mea Shorim. There's a set of buildings over there called Batei Natan, and he'd have to move up, so because he'd have to walk up and down, so that he moved to the third floor. If you've ever seen any of those buildings, you know the ceilings are maybe twice as high as these ceilings, very high ceilings, and so when he had to walk up three flights, it was like walking up five flights. So he had to, you know, come down to daven in the morning. Then he'd have to come back for breakfast and walk up. And whatever he did, he'd have to walk up and down the flights. And he had a tremendous will about him, a tremendous willpower. He was a Navardik, a Mussar, a Mussarnik. And so he walked up and down these things. So when I knew him, which was in the 1970s, this is, you know, 30 years after the Israel Independence Day War, he could walk fine. He walked with a marked limp. His feet were not the same length, and one shoe was one of these stick shoes, but he could do fine. But nonetheless, it was easier for him not to walk. So I took the students to him, and he gave them a very nice Musar Shmuz as only he could. I've never met anybody like him. He had a certain talent. If you knew maybe 200 or 300 words of Hebrew, not a big vocabulary, He could express himself, he could say whatever he wanted to say in 200 or 300 words. He didn't need a big vocabulary without simplifying his ideas. So, these young men didn't have the strongest background, and they came and they didn't know much Hebrew, but he could communicate with them. It was an amazing thing to see. So he gave them a nice Musar Shmuz. So, when the Shmuz is over, it lasted maybe an hour. Time for questions. So one of the boys raises his hand, and he says, "Rebbe, you told us about the importance of living in a Mokom Torah." And he cited the Mishnah in Ovos. You know, if they give you all the pearls in the world, and they give you all the, the gems in the world, to go live somewhere else, don't live there. Live in a place of a Mokom Torah. Okay? So he says, "But Rebbe, What about going to a place where there is no Torah and making a Mokum Torah? What about building Torah in someplace else? What about that? Reb Brooks says, let's have all the questions, you know, on the floor first. Okay? So, another kid raises his hand. He says, Rebbe, you told us it's really important to always strive higher, never be satisfied with the level you're on. Always try to, you know, learn more Torah, have more Avodas Hashem, do better, be more sincere, more committed, always rising, always looking upward. And then he says, but Rebbe, isn't there also an ideal of Menuchas Nefesh, of serenity, of being, you know, at peace with yourself? What about that? Reb Brooks says, let's have all the questions. So, a third person raises his hand, and he asks a question. To my great regret, to this day, I do not remember the question, but it was equally profound. So, you know how it is, if you've got a bunch of questions on the floor, by the time the third question is answered, you already forgot what the first question was. So Reb Brooks repeats all the questions. He obviously understood the questions. And after he repeats the questions, he sits there. Now, he went very short. I don't know if you notice how when you sit down, some differences in height kind of, you know, minimize. Even so, I'm sitting next to him, and he's sitting over here, and even sitting down, he looks up at me. After about a minute, he just sits there. All these three questions are on the floor, and he sits there. He doesn't say anything. He's beaming. He's perfectly at peace with himself. And the boys are kind of wondering, you know, what's happening here? Yes. You have ever noticed when a politician stands up and he says, oh, let's have a moment of silence and because of some tragedy or something, and it's never a moment, a minute of silence. It's never a minute. 10 seconds go by, 20 seconds the most goes by, and the person starts talking. It's very difficult for people to tolerate one full minute of silence. Our Brooks sits there for a whole minute. He's silent. He's beaming. Everything's good. Doesn't say a thing. And suddenly he looks up at me, and he says, Reb Hillel, lo lechol she'ela yesh tshuva. Not every question has an answer. Well, the boys thought that that's, so to speak, that's the Rashi. That's a nice beginning. We're waiting for the Tosfos. Okay? Nice introduction. Meanwhile, he sits there another minute, a whole minute. Sits there a minute. Doesn't say anything. The boys are getting edgy now. What's happening here? What's going on here? They ask questions. He asked for questions. He gave them the questions. And he's perfectly at peace sitting there. Another minute goes by. He looks up at me and he says, Reb Hillel, lo lechol she'ela yesh tshuva. Not every question has an answer. Well, whatever was going on, whatever he meant, whatever was happening, one thing was clear. This Musar talk was over. The boys get up. They're extremely polite. Some of them are bending over. They're kissing his hand, you know, before they go. They're not walking out of the classroom in the normal, or in his, it actually was in his house, this talk. And they're backing out, you know, backing out of the door and very polite and so on, but they're extremely perplexed. The door closes. No sooner does the door close, Reb Brooks says, the students say to me, what did Reb Brooks mean? What's going on? Why didn't he answer us? I had no more idea what was going on than they knew what was going on. I had no idea. Then one kid says to me, oh, didn't you say you learned with him, or you learned privately with him on Tuesday and Thursday? Oh, so you'll go back and ask him what the answers to the questions are. That I don't remember exactly what time of the year this took place, but it was relatively early in the year. It was maybe October, maybe November. And I don't remember exactly when I taught that year, call it Tuesday and Thursday. So, say this talk happened on, for the sake of argument, happened on Tuesday. So I come back to class on Thursday, you know, giving me no peace. these young men. They're giving no peace. What did he mean? What did Reb Brooks say? Did you ask him? Did you go back to him? I'm not going back to him. No, I wasn't going to do that. So they're bothering me. So, I mean, I didn't know. And then next week, over the course of the next 6 months, these young men are bothering me and they're asking me. This is going on, you know, practically the whole year. And I don't have an answer. So after many, many months went by, I think, I can't be sure, but I think I figured out what Reb Brooks was doing. I think I figured out what he meant. I think what he meant was, when he said, Reb Hillel, lo l'chol she'ela yesh tshuva, not every question has an answer, I think what he meant was, not every question has an answer by somebody else. You ask a profound question. These were profound questions. Where do you live? Do you have to live in a Mekom Torah? Are you going to stay in Jerusalem? Are all you girls here, you know, very inspired? This is it. You're making Aliyah, not going home? Or you are going home? And you're going to take some of this Torah with you? What do you do? Which way do you go? We all face these issues. I think what he was saying was, you want me to give you an answer? You ask a good question on the spot. You want me to give you an answer on the spot? It'll go in one ear and out the other. It'll be what I call intellectual resolution. You got a problem? Good. I'll give you an answer. And then once I give you the answer, there's no more problem and I'm not thinking about it anymore. I think what he meant was, if you ask a really profound question and you touch on an issue like, what do I do? Am I always moving upward? Am I dissatisfied with myself? I'm satisfied with myself. I have menuchas nefesh. I don't. These are big issues. So, how do you get to the answer? I think what he was saying was, you have to work through this. I can't just hand you an answer to this thing. You ask a big question, you know, fine, I'll give you an answer. You'll forget it by the time you get out the front door. You'll remember maybe you had a nice experience one day, you met a nice old man, he was sweet and he gave you a nice lecture. Maybe you'll remember, maybe not. 6 months these boys are bothered. I see in retrospect, this is the most brilliant pedagogical lesson I'd ever witnessed. Who's worried 6 months later about something that the Rebbe said in class? These boys, they were upset, they were agitated. And so I think that's what he meant. You got to work through this yourself. Not every question has an answer by somebody else. So, if that's a good question, you know, that is to say, a good question is something that you have to come up with. Pardon me, you have to come up with the answer for it yourself. You got to think through it. So, I want to take it one step further and ask another question. If that's a good question, what's a good answer? I'm supposed to come up with the answer myself. So what's the definition of a good answer? So that what I'm saying here presumes that there's such a thing as a good answer, which is a universal answer. There's something that's a good answer for me is the same thing as a good answer for you, and a good answer for the two Rifkas, and a good answer for, you know, for everybody else. Is there such a thing as a good answer that, you know, could apply to everybody in this room? So let me tell you three stories and see if we can come up with a definition and for a good answer. Story number one. There was, as I'm sure you probably have heard, there was a man named Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. He was the first chief rabbi of Palestine. He was a Talmudic genius. He was one of the geniuses of the Volozhin Yeshiva. And he was a controversial figure. He was a very pious man, but he came to Palestine in 1904. He became the chief rabbi of Yafo, and he had a certain understanding that was not necessarily universally shared about how the religious community ought to relate to the Zionists. Okay, And he was very outreaching to Zionists. He did not tolerate whatsoever the fact they weren't Shomrei Shabbos. He didn't like the fact they were secular Jews, and so on. But he did think that they were doing something positive in building up the land, and he tried to reach them. Okay? In that sense, he was a controversial person, and therefore there were people who opposed what he was doing, and he was an unbelievable genius in his Talmudic studies and in his Machshava. So he became the chief rabbi of Jerusalem in 1919, and then a couple years later, the chief rabbi of Palestine. When the British instituted the mandate, they instituted something called the chief rabbinate. As you may know, this idea of separation of church and state really doesn't apply in this part of the world. There's an official, chief, whatever they're called, of Islam, Christianity, all kinds of government-recognized and funded religions. And that started back in the mandate time. In any case, so Rav Kook had his opponents. So when he was chief rabbi of Israel, he had a shechita. He was responsible for a shechita. So he had his shechita, and then the other rabbonim who opposed him, they had their shechita. He had two shechitas. So they asked him once, what do you eat? You got your shechita, you got their shechita, what do you eat? And he said, his answer was, I don't eat from either shechita. How could that be? He says, well, I can't eat from their shechita because I had nothing to do with supervising it. I don't know how it was done. I'm not saying it was wrong or bad, but I had nothing to do with it, so I can't, confirm or deny, so to speak, that shechita. And then he says, as far as my shechita is concerned, well, these other esteemed rabbonim forbade it, so how can I eat from it? Which person would say that? Who would say such a thing like that? Unbelievable person. These are people who made his life miserable, but they were great talmidei chachamim. I can't eat from my shechita either. That's one story. That's his answer. Okay, we'll come back and see if we can understand that answer a little bit better as we go forward. Then I'll now tell you another story. There was a man named Aponovitcher Rov. Aponovitcher Rov was a famous personality. He built the Aponovitch Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. He was a Holocaust survivor. He was a famous Rov in Europe. And he lost his family in Europe. He came to this country in 1941, 42 or something. And, he built the Ponovitch Yeshiva. Once he was asked, when he was talking about building a Ponovitch Yeshiva in an empty hill, and they said to him, you're dreaming. He said, I may be dreaming, but I'm not asleep. And so he built this yeshiva. Okay, fast forward, it's 1969. The Ponovitch Rosh is dying. He's in a hospital. He's in Washington Heights. Near Yeshiva University, there's some hospital. I don't know which hospital. It was Columbia. I'm not sure. And he was being taken care of by Rav Moshe David Tendler. And at a certain point, he needed a blood transfusion. All right? And Rabbi Tendler is responsible for this. Let me open up a parenthesis and tell you a little something about Rabbi Tendler. Rabbi Tendler was Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law. All of the science that Rav Moshe needed to write his great pesukim, his great tshuvas, he got from Rabbi Tendler, who was a biologist and had a tremendous mind. And he was a Talmid Chacham. He was a tremendous person. He gave a shiur. He was head of the biology department. He gave all the scientific information that Rav Moshe needed. And that's not how I remember Moshe Tendler. I don't remember him for any of this. I remember him for the following reason. I was a student at the Yeshiva College in the late 1960s. In the dining room, there used to be this lady. These days, we would call her a bag lady. This lady used to come into the dining room. It was very annoying, dirty, unkempt. A short person, with her bags and whatnot and the other. And she'd come into the dining room, and a lot of the boys, would turn the other way. They'd look the other way. Not Rabbi Tendler. Rabbi Tendler went up to this lady. He asked her what she wanted for dinner. I don't remember whether he took her into the cafeteria personally or he went in there on her behalf. He bought her dinner. He brought out the dinner. He sat her down. He made sure she was comfortable, gave her dinner, gave her dignity. That was Rabbi Tendler, and I saw that. If I saw it once, I saw it 100 times. That's the Rabbi Tendler I remember. So Rabbi Tendler has to get this blood transfusion for the Ponovitcher Rav. The Ponovitcher Rav says, I'm not having a blood transfusion. He's dying. He needs the blood. And he, in fact, did die, you know, whatever, I don't know, a month or two or sometime later. He says, I'm not taking a blood transfusion from a non-Jew, he says. And they say to Rabbi Tendler, says to him, you have to take the blood transfusion. It's life or death. It's pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh, saving a life, supreme Jewish value. He needs to tell this to the Ponovitcher Rav, is a great Talmud Chacham, but he's not taking the blood transfusion. I'm only taking it from a Jew. Not only that, he has some kind of odd blood type. This is 3 a.m. Rabbi Tendler runs back to YU. Somehow or another, he gets into the medical files, which he probably had access to because he was head of the biology department. He gets a hold of the medical files. He starts looking through the names of boys who have this odd blood type. He finds a boy who has this blood type. He wakes him up in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. and says, here, come, please. Were you willing to give some blood for the Ponovitcher Rav? He says, yes. They get the blood. They go to the hospital. They give him the transfusion, and he survives. So when he survives, and he's, you know, sort of back to himself, so to speak, Rabbi Tendler says to him, how come you didn't take the blood transfusion? The Ponovitcher Rav says, you think I don't know that it's 100% mutter allowed to take blood from a non-Jew if you need it? You think I don't know that? He says, they killed my family. They took my wife. They took my children. They took everybody of mine. You think I'm going to give them the schus of saving a Jewish life? That's his answer. We'll come back to that. A third story. One fine day in 1978, my wife gets the phone rings. I'm not home. My wife gets a phone call. Picks up the phone. Medaberet Gevered Begin. It's Mrs. Begin speaking. My wife saying to herself, I don't know anybody named Begin. Who is this? Medaberet Gevered Begin. It's the wife of the Prime Minister of the State of Israel. It's Eliza Begin speaking to my wife. So what's happening in 1978 is the Camp David talks. Anwar Sadat, the first Arab leader ever to come to Israel since it was founded, comes to Israel in November 1977, and they got these, they're trying to make some peace, and it's not going well, and the sides can't get together, and it's now August or so, 1978, like 10 months or so after Sadat came to Jerusalem, and President Jimmy Carter calls these talks, try to rescue the talks, so there not be another war between Israel and Egypt. And the talks are going to take place in Camp David. And so Mrs. Begin is explaining to my wife, there's a lot to take care of. I got a lot of things to do. You have no idea how important these talks are and how many things there are to arrange. It was well known that Mrs. Begin had her own tzedakah projects. Her own chesed projects. So she's saying to my wife, there's this lady in Sanhedrin Rechevet in such and such a building that I always, whatever it was, I see once a month or I do something for once a month. I just can't do it now. I, I can't get it done before we have to leave for Camp David. Do you think you could go over to this lady and explain? You know where the building is. So my wife says, yeah, sure, sure. So they're talking about this and where the building is and what she should say and what her name is and so on and so forth. In the middle of this whole discussion, suddenly, Mrs. Begin says, you know what? Don't do it. Don't do it. If you go over and you talk to this lady and you tell her, then this lady's going to know that somebody else knows that I'm helping her out. That would be very embarrassing. I'll just have to get it done myself somehow. Thank you very much. Goodbye. That's the end of the conversation. So what was the question that Mrs. Begin had? The question she started out with was, you know, how do I take care of this problem? The answer she ended up with was, you know, the way that I think I'm going to take care of this problem is very different from what I thought to start with. So can we identify a common thread between the answers that were given? First by Rav Cook, I don't eat my own shechita. Then from the Ponovitcher Rav, you know, I'm not taking any blood from a non-Jew. And then from Mrs. Begin, whose, you know, answer is, I got to take care of this myself no matter what else is happening. I can't rely on somebody else. What's the common denominator, I think, at least? You could make your own suggestions, but I think the common denominator between all these answers is they're unexpected. I think if we were to take a little survey here and I were to present to you the question about Rav Cook, you know, which chita did you, eat from? I don't think there'd be a single person in this class would say, oh, I don't eat from either one, including my own. If I were to ask you, oh, why is it that the Ponovitcher Rav would not take a blood transfusion from a non-Jew? I don't think anybody would have come up with the answer that he gave. And then Mrs. Begin, you know, she starts out with a question, how do I get this done? She herself didn't understand what the answer would ultimately be. And that is, I just can't rely on somebody else to do this. So I think what we're seeing here, perhaps, is the answer to a question that you have to come up with yourself. If it's a good question, going back to Rav Brook, there were some good questions asked which he wouldn't answer. And if I'm right, and I think he didn't answer them because he was saying, you have a really profound issue, you have to answer it. You have to work it through. You have to see what you can come up with. So if I'm right, then you know, you got to come up with a good answer. So what's the definition of a good answer? I think what we could possibly say is a good answer is one that's not expected. It's not what comes to my mind, you know, first go around. It's not just something that pops up out of me based on my experience and, you know, my life and my history and my friends and my family, et cetera, et cetera. A good answer is different. A good answer is, as they say, unexpected. A good answer is going to take me someplace that I didn't think I was going. So one of the reasons I wanted to present this today is, I'm making an assumption here, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, I hope your girls are having a good year, learning a lot of Torah, perhaps inspired, you know, learning what you're doing, like what you're doing. What often happens, a common, not necessarily universal, but common trajectory is you're having a great year, and then you go home, the year's over. I know it's not close to being over, but, you know, time goes by. You go home, and all of a sudden the holy air of Jerusalem isn't around you anymore, and all of the studious, you know, the students who are so sincere what they're doing is not necessarily the same, and the teachers and the atmosphere. Just living in the holy city. I mean, I don't have to tell you. You walk outside. It's not like walking in New York or St. Louis or Dallas or someplace. It's different. And we're all benefiting from this. But at a certain point, you'll go home. Maybe a couple will come back for a year or two, but and maybe there's a couple of people in this room will make Aliyah, possible. But the, statistically speaking, most of you go home, and then, you know, it dissipates the spirit, the enthusiasm, the feeling, the special feeling. I'm here for a few days in Jerusalem. I walked into shul. We got here Wednesday night. I walked into shul Thursday morning. Walked in for shacharis. It's a totally different feeling. I don't know the people. I've never been in the shul once in my life. It's a completely different feeling from what I have back in Denver, Colorado. Everything is different. And then you go home. It's not there. So how do you cope? Well, if you can get in the practice, get in the habit, so to speak, of understanding that a lot of the issues that are raised are issues that you need to work through yourself. Reb Hillel, lo lechol she'ila ish tshuva. I can't hand you all the answers. You know, some of the answers have to come from the inside. Some of them have to work through yourself. It's not necessarily easy. And then if the answers are good, maybe they're unexpected. Maybe there are things you wouldn't think that you would ever answer before. I have to tell you that story about Rav Kook. I can't absorb that story. I don't eat my own because the other people who make my life miserable, the other people, they're esteemed Rabbonim, and therefore, they say my shechit is no good, therefore I can't eat it. I mean, how many people can relate to one's enemies like that? So, you come up with answers that are unexpected. If you can kind of get in the habit of that, as it were, thinking things through, asking good questions, asking not only of the teachers, but of yourselves, and coming up with different ways of looking at things, different ways of doing things, not just, you know, I'm doing it this way because I always did it this way. It could perhaps serve you in good stead, not only over the course of the next few months of your studies in the Holy City, but once you go, when you're not going to have all these friends sitting around, you know, who can encourage you and help you. All right. So I'm now going to do maybe what Rav Brook did and ask if there's any questions. Listen. You don't have to worry. I'm leaving soon. There's nothing I can do. I'm not giving any reports to Rabbi Kagan or anything. Yeah.
If like the point of I guess like.
Wait a minute. Remind me again. What's your name?
Nami.
What?
Nami.
Okay, Nami. Yes.
So like we're in this world to like follow Hashem's will, but there's so many like different approaches, and everything's right, but like. How can everything be right and like if everything's not right, like how do we, I guess, know which is the right way to follow?
That's a good question. Well, I would say two things. One, it always helps to have a Rebbe. What's a Rebbe? A Rebbe is a teacher who, somehow or another, you feel you can relate to. A Torah teacher, you can relate to more than the others. Doesn't necessarily relate to, you know, whether they're objectively the, you know, the most brilliant Talmud Chacham or not, but it's a Rebbe, a Madrich, a guy, somebody you can relate to, somebody you can share issues with. I would go so far as to say, if you have no other achievement throughout the course's entire year that you can establish a relationship with somebody you can talk to, that's a great achievement. It's not easily done, it's not necessarily going to be done in the course of 1 year. That's one thing. The other thing is,
can I ask like a follow-up question to that?
Again?
Ask a follow-up question to what you just said?
Sure.
When you're choosing like a rabbi or mentor, like how do you know like necessarily like they're all like learned in Torah but have different approaches and stuff? Like how do you know when you're choosing a rabbi or mentor that it's like that's what you're supposed to be doing versus like, oh, this just like feels good to me, it makes me.
It's subjective. Yeah, feels good. Feels right.
How can like truth be subjective?
Okay, good question. So let's look at the second part of what you were saying, or the second part of what I wanted to say. And that is,
you're exposed to this whole vast, you know, Jewish sacredism. There's the Torah, there's the Rashi, there's the Ramban, and there's Pirkei Avos, and there's, you know, Tanakh, and, you know, I don't know what you're all learning here, but it's here. It would take a lifetime to master everything that's unconscious in this shelf alone. Right? Okay. So, as you're exposed to all of this, some parts of it will speak to you more than others. Rashi will speak to you, the Ramban doesn't speak to you, for example. Or, Tanakh will speak to you. Jewish thought will speak to you. Jewish philosophy. Some pieces of it will speak to you more than others. That's legitimate. That's good. Nobody can master the whole Torah. Everybody has what they call a shoresh neshamah, a soul root, so to speak. So as you sort of instinctively end up following one particular, you know, flavor, as it were, of the Torah, you will find that certain teachers, you know, seem to have a, you know, a greater affinity for that than other teachers do. So it really arises from within. You say, how could truth be, you know, subjective? A good point. But what is subjective is each person. And each person comes to the Torah from, you know, what speaks to your neshama. And different parts of the Torah speak to different people's neshama. That's why there are all kinds of people out there who, you know, go in different paths. This person is a communist. He sits in England's store. He passes in Shiloh. He's got nothing else interesting. This person is interested in Agadita. This person is interested in Muslim. This person is interested in Jewish philosophy. Okay. And it's okay for you to be more interested in A than in B. And then when you are, you will gradually identify Rabbein, teachers, who seem to share that more or less same orientation that you have. And of course, I'm now free to say that if that doesn't make any sense, fine, go struggle with it by yourself. Okay, other questions? It's all right, ask. Yes?
You said that the answers, a lot of the ones to the profound questions, should come from myself, but what if objectively...
I'm coming only close because I have trouble hearing, so I need to get a little closer.
What if objectively the answer that you came up with is wrong?
That's why it's always good to have a Rebbe. Bounce things off of. To share things with. Yes, we all make mistakes. We all go down the wrong path. We all end up with the wrong conclusions. But hopefully we have Rebbes and Chaverim. It's not just, you know, horizontal. Pardon me, not just vertical, it's also horizontal. And, you know, over the course of time, as you get older and older, the availability of the Rebbes gets less and less, and the availability of the horizontal gets more and more. So they're both important. Always have to be sort of checking the conclusions. And of course, one of the ways to check the conclusions is through the study of Musar, which is basically an exercise in introspection. You may be studying Orchos Tzaddikim, you may be studying, Chovos HaLevavos or whatever it is. Okay, Aleh Shur, whatever. But it's basically an exercise in introspection, which is an exercise in guarding against self-deception, if we could generalize. Other questions? Okay, then I have a question. Does he bother you?
No, he's the best teacher ever.
Does he get you disturbed? Does he get you upset? So I thought I'd share that with you. That was a learning experience for me. I knew that when I took my kids to Reb Brook, he was a person of, you know, great wisdom and had a beautiful simplicity about him. and he had a great capacity to speak to people. I would go into his office from time to time. His office was really his dining room table. I remember going there sometimes in the afternoon. He had a chavrus in the afternoon. He's sitting there in his frock and his black hat, you know, and all of that. This chavrus is a painter, a house painter. And he's sitting there with his, you know, his splattered, whatever kind of piece of clothing you call it. And they're sitting there and they're equals. They're sitting there learning. He's sitting there in his black frock. He's sitting there in his painting and they're equals. I'd go in there from sometimes and there'd be these Sephardi ladies. These old Sephardi ladies with their bundles on their back, and they would be unburdening their heart to him, and he would listen. So I hope it's different today, but in those days, there was a lot of discrimination and prejudice against Sephardi by Ashkenazi. Never saw that with Rav Brook. These old Sephardi ladies would come in and they talked. And I saw one event, I'll leave you with this little story. His yeshiva to this day is in Rehov Yoel. It's a tiny little street, probably about this wide. It's a bicycle street, off of Shmuel and Avi, 50 yards up from the street. And there's the main entrance to the yeshiva, but there's a side entrance. And that side entrance opens onto this street, and next to that side entrance is a shtiebel that was headed by a man, Rabbi Tzion Abba Shaul. They used to call Rabbi Tzion Abba Shaul the Chofetz Chaim of the Sephardim. A tremendous Talmud Chacham and a tremendous tzaddik. And so he's over there on that side of Rehov Yoel, and Rabbi Brook now is over here. So I'd walk in Erev Yom Kippur, maybe 5 minutes before Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre was in the yeshivas on the third floor. Brooks' apartment's on the second floor. And I'm walking in there to the Brooks' apartment, and I see the following scene. That the Rabbi Tzion Abba Shaul, who it's hard to describe the esteem that he's held, was held in by the Sephardic community in the land of Israel. He's bounding up the stairs here, and he's coming into Rav Brook's apartment, and he goes up to Rav Brook, and he goes like this, "Rebbe, bless me." Rav Brook is all flustered. What is this? I mean, this is the great Talmud Chacham. This is Rav Tzion Abba Shaul. I'm not roy to bless anybody. Doesn't matter. He's trying to get out of it. Doesn't matter. He doesn't move. Rebbe, bless me. He's not moving. Reb Brook has no choice. He has to give him a bracha. And meanwhile, Rebbetzin Brook is, you know, getting the candles, doing the final, you know, getting the candles ready. This is like 3 minutes now before Kol Nidre. And so he blesses him. He blesses him. And when he's done, guess what? Reb Brook. Rebbe, bless me. Now, Rebbe Tzion Abba Shaul is trying to get out of it. Who am I to bless somebody? But he has no choice. Rebbe Brook just gave him Hema blessing, and he gave him. So I saw this. This is the Sephardi Chacham. This is the Ashkenazi Chacham. And again, in those days at least, I hope it's different now. I don't know. I mean, this didn't happen. Okay? This didn't happen. And I saw that happen between these two people. I'll never forget that. Okay.
But it's kind of out of order, so I wrote it how I remembered it. Just letting you know. I mean, if I was there every class, I think I should be fine.
Can I take you to another room?
Hey, listen. I think I know what's happening.
I was there.
I'm trying to figure out what it says. Don't move it, okay?
It's not grammatically correct. I didn't make it.
Happy Small Tuesday.
I love you. Thank you.
Rivka, you light up my Tuesday.
Hi.
I'm a Gershenfeld.
What's that?
I'm a Gershenfeld. Now I'm a Levy, but I'm Rabbi Goldberg's daughter. I'm Micha. And I did not even realize that Rabbi Goldberg in our school was Gershenfeld. Yes.
You see, I remember something you don't.
Okay, everybody, this is my father's friend.
I remember the kid.
I
was the kiddish when you were born.
Wow.
See, you don't remember that.
No.
Well, that's
wonderful.
So nice to meet
you. Yeah. Small world. I saw on the guest speaker. It's like, wow.
Yeah. So where do you live?
I live here in Harnof.
Wow.
I work here in Midrash Tehillah. Maybe I live in Midrash Tehillah and I live in Harnof. Sounds better.
So nice to meet you. Yeah. How are your parents doing?
Good. I understand you're giving some kind of a Motzei Shabbos.
Something.
Kind of
something.
So my father's in L.A. right now, so I think he'll be back by Shabbat.
I'm just coming to listen to him.
What?
I'm just coming to listen to him.
Listen to him? Okay, good. I'm
that's
gonna
what
come
he
listen
said
to
about.
I'm going to come also. Shabbat's an interesting topic.
Okay, all right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. What are we supposed to do with this?
Oh. I'm going to take it.